and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, as you know, it wasn't that long ago we had our three-minute thesis final for 2025. And so I would like to introduce you to the runner-up of our 2025 event, Danielle Harper, who is doing a PhD in pathology and molecular medicine under the supervision of Dr. Peter Greer. Welcome to Grad Chat, Danny.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Which is great because I always say to the finalists, who's coming on Grad Chat? Because we know we want to get these shows going, and I've already got a taste of what you're talking about, and so I want to know more, which is exactly why I'm very lucky that Danny put her hand up straight away. I'm still waiting for some of the others, so we'll see how all that goes. But thank you for sort of volunteering yourself, and congratulations on that. Tell me, how did you find doing the three-minute thesis in the first place?
It was so much fun. Like, I had been excited to do it since I started grad school. During my undergrad degree at Trent, I did three-minute paper competition.
Fantastic.
In my fourth year, and I just loved it. And I found it was a really valuable sort of learning experience. And it was also really fun to get to learn about other research going on. So yeah, I had been really excited to do it again. And I sort of had been waiting for what I felt was the right time to do it when I had a bit of a story to tell. So
that always helps, doesn't it? Sometimes people come on and they come on way too early and they really have nothing to say other than a thought, which is still good practice to learn about a thought. But the purpose is to sort of relay kind of what you're doing. And it's great that you actually said that in Trent you did a three-minute paper.
Yeah.
So what a great way to get started, because as we know, when you're rehearsing your 3MT, you actually write it all down first to see if it actually makes sense and has that logical flow.
Yeah.
So did that prep from that help you this time round?
I think so. I think it definitely helped try and pick out what the key ideas were and how to make it a very concise story, because you are trying to tell such a big story in such a limited amount of time. So it's really about picking out those key ideas that you want to share. And I think trying to come up with, I always like trying to explain it using analogies and metaphors and things like that. So I think that experience before it was a good practice run for this.
Practice run. Yeah. Well, I wonder if we do that here, because I think that's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
So, because I know even from a three-minute thesis, I was doing a workshop the other day with another program in health sciences. And I was saying, you do your three-minute thesis, you can convert it then into a video, for instance. I know it's not your area, but Shirk Storytellers. You can, with the captions that you put on it, if it has to be heard by people in a different language, you just change the captions to a different language. You can put it on YouTube. So getting your work out further and further afield just from doing one thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I was kind of thinking about that as well. Like, it's not just an isolated event where you're just 3 minutes and that's done and the conversation's over. It's really a chance to practice those communication skills, learn more about the questions people have regarding your research. And I mean, even kind of leading me to today, and we get to have a deeper conversation about it. So it's just really exciting. And I think it's a great opportunity that I would recommend to any grad students. So.
Good answer. I love that one. I love that one. We've got to keep that one going. And I always like to ask too, is what do your mum and dad think about your work now? Do they get it more?
I hope so. I mean, I try my best to explain it to them, and they're always excited to hear about it. And I think it's really good practice to try explaining it to your friends and family. And I talk to my grandparents every week too, and they're always asking me questions about it.
Oh,
and
that's great.
I find it really helpful because I'm sort of forced to find new ways to explain it based on different levels of background understanding. And I find it really helpful to get questions from different angles and different perspectives.
Does that help you not just in how you are doing a particular talk, but also in terms of how you're looking at your research today? Because, I mean, when your research is kind of focused on one particular thing, you've been told, let's work on this, which we'll get to shortly. but having ideas from other people totally outside your field, does that sort of have any impact in how you're looking at your research?
I definitely think so. And I think it almost is like it takes the blinders off, because sometimes you can get too narrowed in and too focused. Mm. If anything, it's definitely a reminder of the big picture and what are the goals I'm trying to accomplish, and what are the applications of my research, and what areas should I be focusing on in order to have results that will have the biggest impacts. So I definitely think it's helpful, not only in the communication, but the actual research itself, and in what research questions you're asking and how you're going about answering them.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Greer is very happy to have you in his lab, because I know he's doing a lot of different things. And I guess some of that comes from new students coming in and saying, have we thought about this?
Yeah.
Or he's had a thought because he's heard something,
yeah,
as you said, maybe from the grandparents of, you know, different ideas. And that's how we start triggering new research projects.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think there's anyone who's come up with an idea all on their own. It definitely all comes from conversations you've had and previous research that's been done. And it's kind of one big conversation, and that's what makes it collaborative and fun. And
collaboration. Yeah. Love that word. Love that word, collaboration. Okay, so I guess we should tell people what you're actually doing, other than the fact that you're in pathology and molecular medicine, which is a very long title for a department, but it covers all sorts of things. And of course, it's in the health sciences. And so your research topic, and most people will probably go, what? It's called genetic disruption of calpain 1 and calpain 2. Which impedes triple negative breast cancer metastasis. I have trouble with that word every time. Basically, you're looking at something to do with breast cancer and something that either helps or hinders.
Yeah, exactly. And
how's that? Just from a title. Look at that. But we're going to find out what this calpain is all about.
Yeah.
So perhaps you can give us a bit of an overview of what you are doing and what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the proteins that our lab focuses on, and I'm sure we'll get into a bit more detail later, but it's called calpain. And some research and clinical studies has shown that there can be overexpression of calpain associated with worse clinical outcomes in breast cancer.
Okay, so it's not good to have it.
No. And these studies have been done across several different types of cancer, but we focus specifically on a subtype of breast cancer called triple negative. And just to kind of give some background on that, triple negative breast cancer is associated with a lack of clinical targets. So these are estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and the human epidermal growth factor receptor, or HER2. So there's those three, ERPR and HER2 receptors that can be targeted by therapies.
But, just to make sure I remember, got that right. So there's a lack of those.
In
the triple
negative.
In the triple negative.
That's where that name triple negative comes from.
Sense.
So it doesn't have those three markers. And there are therapies directed against those three markers. Triple negative, it's not to say it doesn't have targets. It's the word we use for it is it's heterogeneous. So it's very diverse across patients, and even within patients, the tumors themselves.
Right.
So it just makes it very challenging to treat. So
is this one of the worst forms of breast cancer?
Yeah. And it's highly aggressive, highly metastatic. So that means it likes to spread to other organs around the body. And that's what causes those high mortality rates. And it's often diagnosed more in younger women.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a bit scary.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of research going on all over the world trying to identify new molecules within these cancer cells, these triple negative cancer cells that we're able to target therapeutically. So calpain is just one of those, and it's one where we're trying to learn more about its specific roles within the cancer cells. And then essentially what my work looks at is when we disrupt it using genetic approaches. So when there's no calpain in those cancer cells anymore, how do they behave?
Right.
What changes occur? So that's sort of...
What made you pick calpain?
That's a great question.
I mean, apart from it's a fancy name.
Yeah.
Calpain, I think in your title of your theorem, calpain, no gain.
No calpain, no gain.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah. Yes. For me personally, it was one of the proteins that Dr. Greer was working on at the time when I joined the lab. And I think its involvement in breast cancer has sort of stemmed from its roles in processes that are involved in breast cancer metastasis. So it's been studied for quite a long time, but it's sort of only recently we're starting to think maybe we could target this to improve therapies.
Okay, we always want to try and improve therapies. So you've kind of mentioned the problems with triple negative breast cancer.
Yeah.
the challenges in terms of those three triple thingies. So you remembered all those words really, really well. Those three things that are not as obvious in this more, what's the word I'm looking for? Aggressive breast cancer. So other than the challenge of being there's not many there, what other sorts of challenges are there?
In treating this?
Yes.
So probably that it is aggressive and it's often diagnosed at later stages due to this aggressiveness. So I think it's about 10% of cases when it's diagnosed, it's already metastasized. So that makes it a lot more tricky to treat because it's no longer just confined to the primary tumor.
Right.
Because it's more common in younger women than the other breast cancer subtypes are, it's not often detected through mammograms like the other subtypes would be in those routine screening. So there's challenges associated with that as well.
And is that because the breast cells in younger women are more dense, so it's harder to, is that the right way? I'm just trying to remember what happens.
I believe that's the case, but
and
I also,
as you get older, they're less dense, so it's easier to find.
Yeah, but younger women are just also not being screened for it regularly. Oh, so,
of course, the obvious, yes.
Yeah, so there's multiple levels to it why it's...
So just on that then, I mean, I remember I was watching a show and it was about Betty Ford, but she had breast cancer. And then there was suddenly a whole movement. She said to people, you've got to go and get a mammogram, et cetera, et cetera. And so suddenly all the women, a lot of women in the US started doing it and they were able to detect breast cancer a lot earlier. You talked about age, not many younger women get mammograms.
Yeah.
Do you think we need to lower that age so we can start detect more? Because if this is very aggressive, you want to get it earlier than later.
Yeah. And I'm less familiar with sort of the clinical regulations and what goes on there. And I think obviously one of the challenges is always going to be the burden on the healthcare system.
Right.
And in terms of availability for this type of testing. And then the actual testing itself is a type of X-ray. So you don't want to be exposed to that more than you have to.
Yeah. Now they tell me. No.
risk benefit analysis.
Yes.
And also it's still relatively rare amongst young women. So
So until we find it's getting more, then maybe nothing will happen just at this point other than keeping an eye on ourselves.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's a really important part of it.
Well, that makes sense. So how do cancer cells metastasize? I'm getting better.
Yeah.
And how is metastatic breast cancer currently treated?
Yeah, so in order to metastasize, the cells in the primary tumor, they have to overcome a lot of challenges because it's sort of it's a harsh environment for them to travel from the primary tumor in the breast to these distant sites in the bone marrow, the lungs, the brain. So yeah, there's a lot of challenges they have to overcome. So first they have to invade into the local tissue, the breast tissue surrounding the tumor, and then they have to manage to sort of squeeze their way between endothelial cells to get into either the bloodstream or lymphatic vessels. And then they have to be able to survive in the bloodstream or lymphatic vessels until they reach the site where they're going to
thrive.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, is that the right word? Thrive?
Yeah, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then even there, they have to, obviously, there's the immune system that they have to evade. And there are ways that cancer cells do that as well. And then there's a large area of research now actually looking at cancer cell dormancy. So single cells can spread around the body and actually just sit there for a long time. And then all of a sudden, years later, start to grow that secondary tumor somewhere. So
that's not very fair.
No, not
very fair at all. Yeah, because you always hear about the lymphatic system. Like you do not want it in the lymph nodes.
Yeah.
You don't want to detect anything in cancer in the lymph nodes.
Yeah, because that indicates that it started to travel.
And it's moving, so as opposed to being just in one localized area.
Yeah.
So... I think you mentioned earlier the word protease.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so what is it? What are they?
Yeah.
And why are they important to our health?
Yeah, absolutely. So proteases are a type of protein. So proteins do basically all of the work in our cells. If our cells are little factories, they are the workers, but they're also the structural components of the factory, the window, the doors, all the tools inside of it. So proteins do all the work in our cells, and proteases are a special subset of proteins, also called enzymes, and their role is to cut up other proteins within the cell. So they can
cut up in a good way?
Yeah, well, yes. Good ways or bad ways. I mean, they have all kinds of functions. So some you can sort of think of as a cleanup crew. They're degrading proteins that the cell no longer needs. Some will be like calpain, and get into this a little bit more, but they change the function of the protein by cutting off a regulatory domain of that protein, changing its function in some way in that sense. And then sort of structurally, they can help remodel different areas of the cell by cutting up other proteins. So yeah, they're really neat.
So even though we have a genetic makeup, these proteases, proteins can still inflict havoc
on
our system once we're born.
Well, not havoc. They do a lot of really good things as well. So our all of our proteins are encoded by our genes.
Right.
So you have other types of molecules in the cell that actually can cut up DNA, but the proteases themselves just focus on the proteins.
Right.
And they're completely required for life. They do a lot of really important processes. Yeah. So, but sometimes, as we see in the case of calpain and cancer, they can actually have like a pro-tumorigenic role or have some implications in disease.
Okay. Yeah. So let's get on to this word calpain, because it's clearly the primary thing of your work, this word calpain. So what do we currently know about calpain's role in cancer?
Yeah. So like I said, calpains are proteases. They're actually a family of 15 proteases in humans. So we have 15 different versions of them.
Okay.
And most of them are only expressed in certain tissues. So for example, calpain 3 is found in muscles. And it plays a role in muscle function. So the two calpains that I focus on are calpain 1 and calpain 2. They're just named that way because they were the first two to be discovered. And they're found in every cell in the body, which is probably why they were discovered so early on.
Right, yes.
Yeah, so they're found in every cell in our body. And they're unique in this sense of proteases because they don't degrade proteins completely. They just make those little changes that are going to change the function in some way.
And you're trying to find out what that function is.
Yeah, and they have many functions. So there are over 100 targets for it that have been identified inside our cells. And so sort of trying to piece together what the consequences of these different targeted actions are. Yeah.
So in relation to cancer, though, because you alluded to earlier that it's not necessarily good to have them in a tumor.
Yeah.
Or the cancer environment.
Yeah. Yeah. So some early work out of the UK looked at patient tumors, and they did some staining specifically for different calpains. And they found that overexpression of calpain was associated with worse clinical outcomes when they looked at how long patients had survived.
Okay.
So that sort of prompted researchers to look into a little bit more about those specific functions within the cancer cells. And so in our lab, what we do are we genetically knock it out. So we use a technique called CRISPR-Cas9 to knock calpain out in the cells. And then we look at how the cell acts. So those are called cellular phenotypes and how that changes. And in terms of cancer, there are many ways that calpain's involved, and a lot of them have to do with cancer cell signaling. So this is what's going on inside the cell with a bunch of different proteins in order to help that cell either survive, help it evade death, or help it migrate and metastasize.
Right.
So there's all these different processes, and in each of these different cell signaling cascades, calpain's cleaving different proteins found in those cascades in order to help promote these pro-survival, pro-migration phenotypes.
So how are you doing that here? How are you testing that here in your lab here?
Yeah, so we use several different triple-negative breast cancer cell lines. So we use one called MBA-MB231, and those are a human breast cancer cell line. And then I work with a few mouse cell lines.
Right.
So those are called AC2M2 and EO771. So we knock out the calpain gene using this CRISPR-Cas9 technology.
It kind of sounds like whack-a-mole, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
Bam.
Yeah. And essentially the way that works is you have the gene, which is encoded. This is the DNA. And you design a guide RNA. So RNA is the single-stranded nucleotides that are produced in our cells to help express our genes and eventually produce proteins. So we design an RNA that's targeted to the Capan S1 gene, which is part of the calpain 1 and 2 protein. And then an enzyme called Cas9 comes in and it cuts the DNA at that point. And then the cell tries to repair it, but it makes a mistake. And then it actually loses the expression of that particular gene.
So if you're finding that calpain is actually making it worse, you can work on this new RNA string to come in and knock it out.
Yeah, yeah. And then what we're doing is we're comparing how those cells are behaving compared to our wild type cells, just our normal cells. And so we do that in several different ways. So we'll look at how the cells are migrating. So we use different assays to track movement of individual cells.
Right.
Then we'll use a really cool assay called a scratch wound, where we seed the cells down in a plate, and then you have like a monolayer of cells. You introduce a scratch into it, and then you see how long it takes those cancer cells to move into the scratch to close it.
Right.
So that's a fun aspect.
So like a healing of
exactly.
Making a scar over the top and stopping it.
Yeah.
So it's all fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what are you... Are you getting close? I mean, I know you may not be able to answer these things like that, because I know you have to be careful before publications and what have you come out, but are you getting some results that you're happy with, that you're heading in the right direction?
Yeah, yeah. And we probably see this most in our mouse models. So we've engrafted tumors either with calpain or without calpain into mice. And then what we see is that the mice with the tumors that don't have any calpain in them, they have less metastasis to the lungs.
That's good.
And then we do a process called a gene rescue, where we're putting the calpain back into those cells that we've knocked out, and then we see the metastasis come back. So
right,
that helps us confirm that it's most likely related to that loss of calpain.
Ooh. So if you can get that to, I don't know what the percentage has to be for you to say, we've got it. But if you get to that point, then what happens? Because is it the doctors, if they find this particular triple negative breast cancer, can they give you a drug, give you a zap of radiation? I mean, how does it work? What would the next step be once you know, yes, if we can get rid of calpain in this particular area, we've got a better chance that it's not going to metastasize?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think that's still very much a long ways down the line, because we have a lot more to learn. And especially given that triple negative is so heterogeneous and every case is different, we have to make sure that across multiple cell lines and multiple systems, this is the case.
Right.
So I guess
you're doing a lot of modeling, right?
A lot of modeling, yes. And another thing to keep in mind is our mouse work has been done in immunocompromised mice. So these mice don't have an immune system. And that plays such a huge role in both tumor growth and metastasis. So I'm sort of trying to move into a little bit more of immunology work as I try and wrap up and try and look at what happens in model systems where the mice do have intact immune systems, and then actually looking at what calpain's role in the immune system is as well. But that's sort of that's for another episode.
Another research strain.
Yeah. But I guess I'll follow up on this by saying that all of our work so far has also been in using genetic manipulation of calpain. We don't actually have a drug that targets it yet.
Right.
And there are small molecules available that will disrupt calpain's function, but it'll also disrupt the function of a lot of other proteases.
Which
we don't necessarily want, because they do have really important functions in human health. So that's something that's also ongoing work right now, is to develop a calpain 1 and 2 specific inhibitor.
Which you must all think, because, you know, as you said, there's so many different ones and you don't want any drug. You don't want to be hitting the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And yet you see these adverts about certain drugs, and then, you know, it's 5 seconds on the drug, and then the next 25 seconds on all the side effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Which boggles my mind when you think, well, why are you actually taking it with all these other things?
Yeah.
But in your instance, with the being able to sort of pinpoint just one, and as you said, you're really looking at inside the sort of the genetic part as opposed to something right now that can be done by a drug. Is it frustrating for you when you know, look, you've found something and that's very, very exciting, and then you think, yeah, but now I've got to think about this and this?
I wouldn't say frustrating. I'd say it's definitely a challenge, but I think what we're looking at when we're trying to find new therapeutic targets is just sort of one piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And it's trying to figure out what other pieces are going to match up with that in order to give a beneficial therapeutic effect that's going to have the least possible side effects.
Right.
And especially with a lot of cancer therapies, that the side effects are just terrible. So it's trying to, even if there are ways to combine therapies to reduce some of the side effects, that those are also things being looked at within the field. So
I always wonder, and could be totally off track here, we always, whenever we talk about cancer, we talk about, I hope it hasn't gone into the lymph nodes.
Mm-hmm.
Do we look at the lymph nodes first in any of this sort of research that you do? You know, what's showing up in the lymph nodes?
In my work, because the lymph nodes are directly related to the immune system, it's not mm-hmm. something that I've looked into too directly. I did notice in my latest experiments with this EO771 cell line that those cells were metastasizing to the lymph nodes in the mice. So they were forming quite large tumors there.
Right.
So it's definitely something that we do keep in mind and that we're trying to learn more about those specific routes of metastasis.
Well, I think I've just answered my question too, because normally by the time it's got the lymph nodes, you've gone too far into it anyway, and you want to try and catch it beforehand, don't
yeah.
you? So maybe I answered my own question, which is why we don't look at lymph nodes directly, because...
Yeah, I mean, they certainly do in clinical settings. That's something that they biopsy to test to see if it has spread there yet.
Yes.
And sort of help with the staging of it to determine what stage that cancer is spread.
So what's next with this particular study?
Yeah, that's a lot left to do still. Yeah, so getting replicates across multiple cell lines, and then definitely trying to learn more about how calpain loss in the immune system might also have an effect here. Because eventually, if we did have a drug that would inhibit calpain, it wouldn't just be inhibiting it in the cancer cells. It would be a systemic therapy, and it could potentially inhibit calpain all throughout the body. So we have to consider the potential effects of that as well.
Are there other studies going on right now anywhere in the world that's looking at something similar? I mean, do you collaborate with other labs?
Yeah. There's definitely lots of people studying calpains sort of in all different disease contexts all over the world. And there's also a protein in the body called calpostatin that inhibits calpain, but that's naturally occurring. So there's work going on in the UK that's looked at
that.
The calpain field is not huge, but there are definitely people looking into it all over.
Do you have an opportunity to go and sort of look in on what they're doing and talking about collaboration, so saying, well, this is what I'm finding in this particular instance, what are you finding, and maybe there's something that you can learn from each other to help your own particular project?
Yeah, for sure. We used to have a conference specifically dedicated to calpain biology.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so okay. I attended one in Lisbon, Portugal in 2022, and it was a fantastic experience.
Yes.
And it was getting to chat with people from all over the world on their various calpain projects. I don't know if that meeting's happening again because the field has gotten kind of small, but hopefully we'll pick it up again. And
maybe you need to sort of lead the charge on that,
Danny.
Come on, you can do that. So okay, I'm going to go on a different track altogether.
Sure.
You are the president of Queen's Cancer Research Club.
Yes.
What does that actually mean? Because I know you know we have the cancer trials here.
Yep.
We're very lucky to have the Sinclair Cancer Research Institute.
Yeah.
Is that all part of it, or is it just this is a student run club? Or?
Yeah, so it's just a student run club. It started when I had just started here, so about 2020. It must have been just as we were picking things back up after COVID and being able to meet in person again. And it originally started as a journal club where graduate students could get together and discuss recent papers that had come out. And it sort of transformed into a place where grad students could come and practice sharing their research in front of their peers. We don't let any professors come, so it's a completely...
There's a big...
Yeah,
exactly. No profs allowed.
Yeah, I did have to escort Dr. Greer out one time, but... No, we just want to make everyone have an environment where they feel like they can come. There's no pressure. It's just for us to practice sharing our work and invite undergrads to come in and hear about the work that we're doing as well.
Brilliant.
So it's really become sort of a peer mentorship group and a chance to practice presentations. We run a seminar on how to make a scientific poster for the undergrads. So just to kind of share what we've learned. And it also just provides a chance for us to kind of see that we're all in this together and everyone's projects is so unique, but the experience is pretty similar. And are frustrating days where you feel like nothing's gone right and you just sort of need to vent to your friends about that and sort of ask for some advice on certain experiments. And so I found it really, really helpful just to get together
once
a week.
And so I guess you sort of, if anyone's going to a conference, you can practice on all of that.
Yeah.
It's great that you're allowing undergrads in because they need to be exposed to what research is about.
Yeah.
And they've probably got a lot of good ideas themselves.
It's a lot of fun and it's always exciting to have new students come out to our seminars.
That's really good. And you're also involved with the Science to Business Network, which I know is a great network and gives you lots of contacts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that networking, definitely. Those networking opportunities. So what made you want to get in part of that?
Yeah, so I got involved in that through one of our previous postdocs in our lab, Victoria Hoskin. She had invited me to help out with their national mentorship program a bit. And the idea with that program is that graduate students get paired with a professional in the industry that they're interested in working in.
Brilliant.
And then they get to have virtual meetings throughout the year, and there's a few virtual networking events that get hosted. So it's been a really cool experience to sort of get to see like the wide range of careers that are available out there, because there's some jobs that you've never even heard of before, and probably new jobs being created all the time. So yeah, so that's been really fun to get involved with.
And I think it's really important that you do, and thank you for mentioning that, because we have these ideas of what one particular job or I can only get into this field.
Yeah.
And we forget, you know, yeah, but the skills I've got, I can actually do this and I can do that.
Yeah.
And that's one thing we keep trying to tell you, grad students, think outside the box a little bit, because you're learning a lot of things as you're going along. So
yeah.
It's, and having that mentorship, that's
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found it really helpful, even though like I'm hoping to continue in academia at least for a bit and carry on in a postdoc, but just to sort of get more exposure to all of the opportunities
yeah.
that are available. I think it really, yeah, it's really helpful and yeah, exciting.
I love it. Exciting. I love that. And something even more different, and I can totally understand where you're coming from here. You love to read historical fiction and watching period dramas and
yep.
stand-up comedy. Not so good with stand-up comedy, but period dramas and historical fiction, love. So I'm right with you on that one. And the other thing is you love your animals and
yeah.
you've got two rabbits, Harry and Dobby. I just love it. When I heard the names of them, I thought, oh, I can totally understand
yeah.
that. That's awesome.
Believe it or not, I didn't name them at the same time.
Oh, did you?
No, I had Harry first and I had another rabbit called Tetley, named after the tea.
The tea, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then she passed away and I didn't want Harry to be on his own. So then I saw an ad on the Humane Society for a bunny called Dobby and I was like, well, that's a sign.
Yeah, it's a total sign.
Yeah.
And you need to pay more attention to sort of like the Humane Society
yeah,
and those fostering sort of places, because
yeah.
there's some lovely animals out there that need a good home.
Yeah.
So Dobby is very lucky, and so is Harry, I reckon, on all of that.
Yeah, they're happy bunnies. Yeah, I love them.
So, Danny, you know, as usual, I've come to an end. So I just want to say thank you very much for coming on the show and explaining a bit more about Calpain and breast cancer, the triple negative breast cancer. Yes, got it right. See, the memory's still there, thank goodness. So thank you very much for coming on and explaining that, and good luck with the rest of the work that you're doing with it.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Good, good. So I love it when they say that. And then this is what I actually have to sort of end up with is, so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.